Welcome in to the Boston Sports Summit presented by the Grid Network. I am your host, Tim Barnard, and it is great to be back. We had a whole slew of events going on in Boston over the course of the last week, one of which being the Celtics are just ready for the playoffs. They're ready. You know, I think last night's game was, you know, for lack of a better word, a joke. Just because, you know, they're like, we're the best team in the East. There's no reason to be scared of anybody, you know, jumping us. We got the best record in the NBA. We're fine. And that's kind of what I felt with last night. Plus, Jaylen Brown scored 10,000 points. But we'll get to that in just a little bit. Plus, the Bruins, and they have been off to quite a turn of events since Jim Montgomery yelled, screamed, cussed them out at practice just a couple weeks ago. And I think that's worth looking into. Plus, that game last night was not their best. I think that they probably should have gotten beaten by a few extra goals. But again, hey, you can't get them all. You can't win them all. And if you know what, if we're saved a few extra goals, then that's not a bad thing. Plus, is Jim Montgomery coming around on the we're going to play playoffs by committee? Maybe. And then we got the Patriots. Draft season is coming up. I keep talking about this. We have just two more weeks from tomorrow, 15 days until round number one. And I'm going to give you who my top six quarterbacks are and why. And then finally, we're going to start the show off with the Red Sox. The Red Sox have gotten off to a very interesting start. They jumped out of the gate like I haven't seen before. I'm just saying they got off to a start that I wasn't predicting. I thought they were going to suck. I thought at best they were going to get three, maybe four wins on that West Coast trip, and then we'll ride it out. But they came back home with a 7-3 record. They looked pretty good. And then yesterday happened. And first and foremost, I want to start off with the 2004 Red Sox reunion. And the way I have to talk about this is, I mean, zero disrespect. What they did for Tim Wakefield and Larry Lucchino, I thought was phenomenal. A lot of feels, a lot of emotions. You know, Tim Wakefield was just a heck of a ball player. The guy, you know, resembled what it meant to be a team player. And the fact that he got his 200th win all wearing, you know, Red Sox uniform, I thought was great. And if you don't remember, Tim Wakefield was in his final season. He made the All-Star game and he was sitting on 199 for, honestly, it felt like several months before the Red Sox offense finally woke up with him on the mound and they were able to secure a 200th victory for Tim, which is just a heck of a feat. So the tribute for what they did for Tim Wakefield and Larry Lucchino, nothing short of phenomenal, excellent, and something that I'm glad they did. But how they coincided the 2004 reunion with Tim Wakefield and Larry Lucchino's passing in the Wakefield family, because Tim's wife, Stacy, also passed away as well, which is just tragic after, you know, 5 months apart. But the way they combined it, it was too somber for my liking. And what I mean by that is, they have the 04 montage of all the events from the offseason all the way to them winning the championship and, you know, folks' famous underhand to Minkiewicz. They had American Pie as the song that played throughout the entire montage. And they were able to fit it because American Pie is a long song. It's, I think, seven and a half minutes, maybe eight. But the montage was great. Like, I loved it. They just set it up with American Pie. And I'm wondering if that's because it was a long song and they wanted to do that. I mean, they could have gotten several, you know, songs. I mean, you could have started off with Cliche as Hell playing Dirty Water by the Standells and then wrap it up with Shipping Up to Boston or something like that. And then you had the 04 players, all of which were walking out to You'll Be in My Heart Tonight by Phil Collins from Tarzan. And I sat there just like, what are we doing? Why am I like, you know, feeling all these emotions that I should be happy, right? I don't want to cry. I don't want to sit there and, you know, reminisce and look back on it like it's a, you know, it'll never happen again type moment. No, like this was exciting. I was 12 years old living the whole season. Like, it was great. I loved every second of it. But the fact that they had them walk out to that, you know, it kind of bummed me out. It pissed me off. Because what they should have done, in my opinion, was they should have either, one, separated the two, you know, had Wakefield on day one, you know, the Wakefield and Lucchino on day one, and then the 04 Red Sox tonight, day two. Or what they should have done was bring out the 04 Red Sox, show the montage, have the Dirty Water and Ship It Up to Boston, you know, as the songs throughout the whole montage, make it as long as you want, add those hype songs. Everybody's like feeling it. They're getting the jolt of energy. And then you introduce the 2004 Red Sox. They come out of the Green Monster and you have Tessie by the Dropkick Murphys playing. Everybody's hyped up, cheering them on. It's loud. It's a big ovation because they are the team that came back from 3-0 against the Yankees. First team to ever do that. And they broke the 86-year curse of the Bambino. So that, you know, everybody should have like felt that jolt of energy, like, let's go, you know, the Tom Brady, let's go. And then once they get to the mound, that's when you take a step back, you have everybody settled down, you play the Wakefield and Lucchino montage to the songs, and then you pull out You'll Be in My Heart Tonight. You introduce Tim Wakefield's daughter, who's going to throw out the first pitch. Everybody's kind of like, you know, in that somber mood. It's like, okay, hey, we celebrated the team correctly, and now we're honoring, you know, the Wakefield family and Larry Lucchino and his family and bring everybody back down to earth and, you know, away, right? That was my opinion, because when I saw that, it was too somber, in my opinion, to celebrate the 20th anniversary, not 13th, not 21st, not 19th. No. The 20th, a nice round number. 20 years ago this season, the Red Sox pulled off a freaking miracle to beat the Yankees and then go on to the World Series to sweep the Cardinals. But they didn't. They just made the whole moment just somber, sad, in my opinion. And if you felt that way, let me know. If you didn't, if you loved what it was, let me know. Tell me. You can comment right below. You can also reach out on Instagram, Boston Sports Summit, on my ex, Boss, B-O-S, Sports Summit. Also up on YouTube, Boston Sports Summit, and the show is on the Grid Network, GRYD, Grid Network's YouTube channel, every Wednesday live, 7 p.m. But to me, that whole 04 reunion coinciding with, you know, the Wakefield's, passing and Larry Lucchino's passing, it was just too somber. They did too much of a blend rather than have one than the other. You could comment below, let me know, and please, just takes 2 seconds. Like, subscribe. It helps with the algorithm and all of that. But to get on to the game and the Red Sox, 11 games in, and I'm asking myself, what do we have? So all offseason, you know this, I have been bashing the Sox over and over and over again. Every chance I got, because, well, part of it is the fact that they just left themselves wide open to the criticism because they wouldn't keep their mouths shut and just kept tossing up softballs that, of course, I have to just, bam, take out of the park, right? But they started off, you know, 7-3 in 10 games. And I was like, all right, here we go. You know, I felt pretty good. But then yesterday happened. And right now I feel like we're looking at a 7-4 Red Sox team that is on the verge of a collapse. Because Trevor Story, done for the season. Nick Pivetta was just put on the 15-day DL with a right elbow flexor strain. And I truly believe it clearly has affected this team. It's clearly affected this team due to the fact that look at what we saw yesterday. Look at that product. Like I said, I felt good going into this game. I'm like, listen, I felt, you know, I wasn't saying we were going to sweep the O's, but I was like, all right, hey, this team can compete. This team can show up against Baltimore. They're throwing out their ace. We're throwing out our ace in Bayo. And I'm like, let's see what we can do, right? Well, the Sox had as many hits as they did errors, right? They had two hits and two errors, both of which were just 2023 Red Sox written all over it. They were bad. They were really bad. And for those of you who missed it, Jaron Duran trotting over to his right to catch a fly ball in left field. And it definitely hit that blend of, I think it was going from sun to shade. You know that feeling when you're in the outfield and you have to adjust because all of a sudden you get that shade, you know, after being in the sun, your eyes have to adjust that quick second there. And he just blatantly missed the ball. Blatantly. I think it hit off the tip of the glove or whatever. He should have had that. I'm sorry. He should have had that. And then David Hamilton, the shortstop, fill-in basically for Trevor Story, ball went right through his legs in the eighth inning. It was bad because here's the thing, though. I have no problem with the Sox losing 7-1, 6-1, 8-1, whatever it might be, because it happens, right? You're going to lose badly in a 162-game season. But watching that game, I felt like you could just see the lack of focus, the melting down, Duran blowing up, kicking himself to the point of borderline toxic. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a second. But like I mentioned, Hamilton with the ball going through his legs. Like, it's just they give these teams extra outs. And clearly they're taking advantage of it. You know, they did that in Anaheim. You know, the Red Sox are, what was it, top five, I think it was, in terms of errors this season. You know, they're top five. They're the number five team with 10 errors this season. So they're not playing good defense, and they're third worst in terms of fielding percentage. And this is exactly the team that we saw last year, pretty much. The Red Sox brass kept saying, if we play better defense, we would have won, I think, what, 5-10 more games, which would have put them in the playoff hunt or even in the playoffs for that matter. And so they were building up defense, defense, defense. And I get Trevor Story is a good defensive shortstop. And when you don't have a good defensive shortstop, it's going to screw everything up. And I get that. But you have to you have to be ready for injuries. And it's terrible that Trevor Story is now done for the season. You know, heading into yesterday's game, you know, with some of the games out in Anaheim and Seattle, you know, this team could have very easily been 9-1, let alone 8-2. But the idea of this culture change that they were promising and promoting for, you know, coming out of spring training for that matter, where was it yesterday? Because that culture change, you know, in terms of playing better defense and getting ready and doing all that, it definitely did not show. Definitely did not show. And here's the other thing about culture change is eventually talent's going to catch up on you. If you're not filled with talent, you're playing teams that are, it's gonna catch up on you. Both the Red Sox and the O's have an average age of 28.4 years old. So you're basically the same age. You're both of them are on the younger side of Major League Baseball. And I think comparing the Red Sox and the Orioles are like a perfect example, because on the Red Sox side and the Orioles side, excuse me, you have a team that's young and good, and they just called up the number one Major League Baseball prospect in Jackson Holliday. So I don't know if he plays tonight, but he'll probably play in this series. So you have a team that's young and good. Red Sox, on the other hand, are young and suck. And yesterday proved it. Corbin Burnes, the Orioles ace, it's funny because when you look at that, Baltimore, yeah, they gave up a couple prospects. They gave up, what, the 34th overall pick or something like that. They gave up an early second-round pick in the draft. But that's it. That's all they gave up for this guy. And clearly, he's exactly what the Orioles need. You know, he's just that type of dude. And he kicked our ass. I mean, so far this season, he's gone at least 6 innings in his 3 games and going 7 strong yesterday. I mean, he's a stud. He's got a sub 1.5 ERA, and he's as much as everything the Orioles paid and more, right? He's worth it. And you could have had him because this is his final year. He's technically going to be a rental, and he's going to be a free agent at the end of the season. You could have had him for a fairly good price, yet this is where we're at. This is what, you know, we have to deal with because our ownership didn't want it. Our ownership was solely focused on not spending any money, trying to make sure that our farm system is a top farm system. And yet they're like, nah, we don't care about the major league team. And then if you want to look at a post game, oh man, like all the comments galore. Starting off with Alex Cora saying, this is where we're at. You're 11 games in, and this is where we're at, quote unquote. Like, Alex, what are you doing? I know that you're probably done with this organization. You're done with this team. And I think it's going to show. But to sit there 11 games in and say, this is where we're at, I'm just like, you know, at least give us a couple months, you know, at least try to ride it out and just say, let's get to June, maybe get through June. And then you can say, well, hey, this is where we're at, guys. You know, sorry, you know, I'm trying here, but we just don't have the product on the field. We just don't. That then fine. I get it, because clearly Cora's tenure as a Red Sox manager is done. It's done. And I hate to say that because I love Cora. I think he, you know, could have been a great manager for a long time. But Cora is the type of manager in baseball that can only manage teams when they're playoff contenders. You know, like they're always in the hunt. They're willing to spend. They're willing to make trades at the trade deadline, give up the prospects in order to sign, in order to get guys that can help propel the team to a championship. And you know what? I don't blame them. I don't blame them, because to be a manager that is solely focused on rebuilding and solely focused on, you know, just getting by, like the Tampa Bay Rays, like the Oakland Athletics. I mean, 162 games is a long time to manage a team that just flat out sucks. Like that, I can totally understand why he would, you know, want to be done. And the next team that he goes to, you know, heck, it could be the Dodgers, you know, from Dave Roberts, you know, might get kicked out, and then, you know, Alex Cora would sign, and then he could win like 5, you know, World Series. Like, it's It's crazy. But for Cora to already, kind of give up, by saying this is where we're at, 11 games in, like, come on, man. Really? You can't just prolong that a couple more months. Also, Trevor Story, listen to him post-game, cry in the locker room, talking about how he's going to have his shoulder surgery at the end of the week. I mean, I feel bad for the guy. I really do. He's a guy that loves the game, wants to be out there, and wants to be a part of, this team, and wants to help this team improve and get better. But it's, he just keeps coming up with these freak injuries. And I don't want to blame him, but let's not forget that we signed Trevor Story as a safeguard for Xander Bogaerts. And, that's kind of a sticky situation. You're preemptively bringing a guy on, knowing full well that if the guy that you want doesn't come to your number, you're comfortable letting him walk. And that's that. I definitely have a problem with that. But also, too, Trevor Story offensively, he was batting .300 to start the year. He's not a number .300 hitter. He sucks outside of Coors Field. And part of the reason he sucks outside of Coors Field is because he actually can see what breaking balls actually look like. Because in case you didn't know, being in that high altitude in Colorado, the ball doesn't break. Excuse me. The ball doesn't break as much as it would in Fenway, for instance. So for Trevor Story, seeing a curveball go 12 to 6 is more like 12 to the middle of the clock. Whereas at Fenway, it goes 12 to 6. I mean, look at Josh Beckett. Look at his curveball back in the day. That thing started your head and dropped to your knees. It was probably the greatest curveball outside of Barry Zito I have ever seen. But Trevor Story as a hitter is replaceable. His defense, okay, we have to go out and find a guy, but his offense is absolutely 100% replaceable. And that's kind of where all these different scenarios are coming out of the woodwork, one of them being bring Rafaela down from center field to shortstop, which I believe you would screw up your outfield, but without a solid shortstop, it's tricky. It's tough. And that's why I kind of look at that and go, unless the Red Sox want to go out and trade for a guy, bring him in, do that type of work, and pay for a guy, I don't know if they're going to do it. I really don't. And that's going to be the tough part to sit here and reflect on. Trevor Story's out 9 games into the season. And you have, it's April 10th. It's been, two games since his injury. And you have until the end of July to make a trade. And I guarantee you, if the Red Sox do actually make a trade for a shortstop, the guy's going to be like a number eight hitter, and he's going to be, average to slightly above average defensively. And he's going to be cheap. They're not going to go out and make a trade for a big-name guy. They should, because they have all the assets in the world to do it, but they won't. So Trevor Story being hurt sucks, for a lot of reasons, but in terms of the year being over because Story's hurt, shouldn't be a thing at all. We got some breaking news here on the Boston Sports Summit. Drew Holiday is extended by the Celtics. Whoa. Coming to you here first via Mike Guido. Thank you, big guy. Yeah, let's pull that up there because I am intrigued to see what just happened. Obviously, you got to go to Twitter for that one. The Celtics and Jrue Holiday have agreed on a four-year, $135 million contract. Wow. Per sources, and I love it. What can I say? I think it's great. Yep. There it is. 4 years, $135 for Jrue Holiday. Yeah, appreciate that, Mike. But yeah, wow. Jrue Holiday getting extended. I know we're jumping around here going from Red Sox to Celtics, but just as a quick off note, I mean, that's huge. Like, I like Holiday. I like his game. And I think he's a perfect complement to this team. You have White as the true point guard. You have Holiday that can come in off the bench. You have Holiday that can kind of that can be the number two. And then you move Brown to number three, Tatum to four, Porzingis at five with White as the one. Love it. Let's go, Celtics. Keep it going, man. And the only thing I'm wondering is how is this going to affect Tatum's $300 million contract at the start of this season? And we got Not Doug chiming in. Let's go, Celtics. Love the extension. Yep, 100%. I'm a big fan. I just wonder what the salary cap's going to look like for the Celtics. Well, obviously, we know the Celtics, the NBA doesn't have a cap. They have a luxury tax. But I wonder what that's going to look like with Tatum's upcoming max contract. He's going to be the highest paid guy in the league. So that's going to be wild to see what happens. But getting back to the Red Sox, the one thing I wanted to bring up, which was kind of scary in a way, kind of telling and kind of scary. So Jarren Duran, I mentioned earlier, Jarren Duran had a bloop fly ball out in the left field. Bloop, kind of. It definitely was tailing off. And he had every ability to catch it, didn't. And he, after the game, he was kicking his chair, and I thought he got into a pretty dark place when talking about his performance 11 games into the season. Okay, now this guy has been dealing with mental health issues, and I'll get to that in just a minute, but I do want to say this. Jarren Duran to the media comes out and says, quote, "I just bleeping suck, man. Bleeping, it's my bleeping fault. If I make that play, we get out of the inning, and then none of those other bleeping things happen. I just bleeping suck." Now, before I continue on to that really dark place that Duran gets to, I want to say, good. Yeah, you should have had that ball. Like, I am all for athletes taking accountability and saying that, hey, that was on me. Ball was in my hands. Ball was in the glove. I should have had it. I should have gotten the out to end the inning. You know, blah, blah, blah. It's on me. Facts. It 100% was on Duran, and I totally appreciate him doing that. Unlike Devontae Parker in the game against Oakland, I think it was, where the ball was literally in his hands, and then when pressed about it in the press game or post game, he's like, "I don't know. Go watch the replay. I don't know." Like, no accountability at all. So, Duran, thank you for taking accountability in that. But this is game number 11. And this is the dark place that he gets to, saying, quote, "I might have to buy another journal for how much I'm going to write about myself tonight. Good thing it was a 2 o'clock game, so I've got more time to talk trash about myself for the rest of the day. And then I'll flush it and get over it." End quote. To buy an extra journal to write how much you suck, and you could do it more because it's a 2 o'clock game rather than a 7 o'clock game. It's game number 11 of 162. Like, that definitely says to me, from a guy who's got a mental health history, relax. It's okay. All right? Listen, it happens to everybody. There is not a baseball player, there is not a Hall of Famer that doesn't have bloopers, you know, out there. Okay. I mean, that was part of the fun of watching the not top 10 and watching Major League Baseball, is because normal guys like me and you, you know, watch these guys drop balls, make errors, and you're sitting there, or I'm sitting there going, hell, I could have made that play. Like, what are we doing here? You know, Bill Buckner in 86. Like, 99.9% of the time, that play would have been made. Jarren Duran. Okay, yeah, you want to talk about the sun and the adjustment going from the sun to the shade. Sure. But at the end of the day, that's still on him. And he takes accountability for it and doesn't bring up the sun and doesn't say all that, which, good. Thank you. But then to go into that deep, dark place, you know, coming from a guy that has had a mental health history, that's kind of scary, you know, and because it's game number 11 of 162. There is still 151 games left in the season, right? Game number 12 is tonight, is actually going on right now as we speak. And so that's why I sit there and I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, let's pump the brakes there, big guy. You know, I mean, I don't know how much you know or even remember. Magic Johnson played game number one of his career, and Kareem hit a buzzer beater to win the game, and Magic leaps into his arms, and Kareem's like, get off me, you know, and kind of scolds him because it's game one of 82. And, of course, Magic has that great comeback saying, if you hit a shot like that, you know, for every single game, I'm going to jump into your arms every single time. So it's kind of that, just that mentality where you're in your extremes every time. And trust me, I'm known for beating up on myself a lot, and it's not healthy. You know, sometimes there are days where it's like, you know what? I just need to forget about everything. And I just need it to be tomorrow. Once tomorrow hits, bam, I'm a new guy. You know, I'm back at it. I'm back to where I was. And maybe that's what he needs. But to say that, you know, he has to go write a brand new journal and just talk about how much, you know, for lack of a better word, he sucks. Like, dude, like, let's take it easy, you know? And I also don't want this to be kind of like and I'm not saying he's doing it. No. Like, I just want to disclaimer right here. What I'm about to say does not reflect my views on what Jarren Duran is doing. I truly believe that he's, you know, this is the type of guy that he is. And I truly think that he needs some help. You know, I truly think that he needs some help, and he needs guys to be, you know, all like, just, hey, let's relax. You know what I mean? But I also don't want this to be a thing where I can't criticize, or fans can't criticize, players who suck, who don't do their job, who, you know, drop easy plays, you know, easy balls or whatever, because of a mental health stigma either. You know, with Duran, like I said, I can sit here and appreciate him saying, I should have had that, you know, in far less words than the way he said it. But, like, that's the thing that kind of bothers me. You know, like, I don't want this to be a thing. I don't want this mental health thing to get backlash where it's like, you can't say that he's dealing with mental health. Why? Because that's his job, to make that catch, you know, to make these plays. You know, like, that's, I don't want that to be a thing, all hiding behind the mental health stigma. And like I said, I truly believe he's dealing with some, you know, mental health issues. And I hope he gets help and, you know, turns it around and is a very positive guy and, you know, can be happy, right? And not kick himself so hard. You know, like, I don't want him to do that. But at the same time, that doesn't mean I'm not going to critique him either, because he should have had that ball. I just don't want other athletes to see how much the mental health stigma, you know, mental health thing is, and just say, oh, I'm dealing with depression. Oh, I'm dealing with mental health issues. When in reality, they're just hiding behind it. So That's kind of my thoughts. But also, it's not just Trevor Story that got hurt. It's Nick Pivetta. It's his first time ever going on the disabled list or injury list. It's still the DL in my book. I mean, it's so dumb. But 31 years old, entering his eighth MLB season, he's made 198 career appearances, including 154 starts. The only other time Pivetta was on the disabled list was in 2020 for COVID. The dude has not been hurt. Same with Lucas Giolito. Two guys who have just, you know, Iron Man, basically. Like, they have played their whole careers never dealing with, you know, an injury physically to them. And then Giolito's done for the year. And Pivetta is now done. So, why is it? I mean, pitchers want to keep saying that it's all about the pitch clock. It's all that we – they sped up the game. I don't believe that. I never did, and I don't like guys saying it because it is kind of ridiculous that they're complaining about speeding up the game and actually getting the game over from a five-hour game, a six-hour game, to now it's down to 2:15 to 2:30, which, thank you, finally, I can actually, you know, can go to sleep at a reasonable time. But when you look at Baseball Savant on MLB.com, it has a whole thing to do with pitchers and their pitches and all of that. So it notes that Pivetta threw 1,206 fastballs, which is 50.6% of the time last season. In his sweeper or slider, he threw 128 times and was a 5.4% of the time in 2023. So far in the, two games that Pivetta has been in, his fastball is down to 32.8%, where his sweeper is up 26.4%. So he's thrown his sweeper five times more than he did last season. And you're wondering why he's hurt. You know, you're wondering why the arm injury has, you know, is real, right? And when you actually Google, you know, just do sliders cause arm injuries, you know, literally the first thing you see is overall, like, this is front page on Google before you even click on anything. It says, quote, overall, only the slider was found to have significant relationship to elbow pain, and this relationship was especially strong among, yes, younger pitchers, 13 to 14 year old pitchers. But even if it's 13 and 14 year olds, I that absolutely has a correlation to older pitchers as well, because Pivetta five times more in two games on top of trying to figure out the pitch, I guess, or harness the pitch during spring training. So he threw it however many times in spring training, and now in games is up five times, going from 5.4% last year to 26.4% this year. Like, that's crazy to me. And this guy who's never been hurt, really? We're gonna go down that path? I don't know. I still don't believe it's a pitch clock and never will believe it's a pitch clock. But moving on to some draft talk. We got the New England Patriots sitting at number three. And one of the things that I wanted to do was I wanted to watch some of the film and kind of evaluate just for myself, you know, what I see in these guys, what they and how they are 1 through 6. Because at the end of the day, I think the Pats are going to take a quarterback at number three. I just think they are, whether that's good for them, bad for them, you know, that's a topic that, you know, we can debate until next season, until 5 years from now, right? But when looking at the top prospects, we got Caleb Williams, Drake May, Jaden Daniels, Michael Penix, Bo Nix, and J.J. McCarthy, okay? So when watching their films and watching kind of their styles, I think obviously, you know, Caleb Williams, without a doubt, is – the most talented quarterback in this draft. This is, in my opinion, the top quarterbacks in the NFL draft are as follows. Caleb Williams, Michael Penix, J.J. McCarthy, Jaden Daniels, Drake May, and Bo Nix. And I'm going to go through each one of them, but I'm going to start with Bo Nix first. Because Bo Nix, to me, going from 6-1, Bo Nix, I think he's got a decent enough arm. I think he can survive in the NFL. He's got some good mobility to him, as, seen in Oregon. But I cannot forget his time at Auburn. He spent, three, four seasons at Auburn, and the dude just sucked. He was not good at Auburn. And if you want to talk about the scheme, the system, sure. That probably was the reason why he wasn't good. But there was also a lot of hype that Bo Nix had to live up to at Auburn because his father played at Auburn. And so now here's the kid. Here's a lot of pressure that this kid has to live up to. So how much did that really affect him? Because, again, that type of pressure is wildly different than being a top draft pick in the NFL. And I truly believe that. Even if Bo Nix is, first pick of the second round, if he's, the 23rd draft pick in this draft class, 23rd overall pick, if he's the number one, by some crazy chance, he's the number one overall, I still believe the pressure that he felt going to Auburn, having his father play for the team, being in the SEC, playing for his father's team, is just a wildly different type of pressure than what he could be in the NFL. And that's kind of what scares me with Bo, is the fact that you have to design basically the Oregon system to fit him, right? You have to basically take everything that they did in Oregon and bring that same thing to the NFL, I believe, for him to succeed. Because if he were able to succeed at Auburn, he wouldn't have transferred to Oregon. That team wouldn't have been what it was. You know what I mean? So I think Bo Nix has the abilities to play in the NFL, but is he going to be a starter? Is he going to be, a leader? Is he going to be the guy? I don't think so. I don't think Bo Nix will ever be the guy. But the number five, and it's going to surprise a lot of people, the number five kid is Drake May. I have Drake May at number five. And I like Drake May for the sheer fact that he is a prototypical quarterback. He's 6'4", 6'5". He's about 220 to 30 pounds. I think he's 230. And he has got an absolute cannon for an arm. And I love that fact. I think that's great that he can do that. A lot of people are trying to compare him to Josh Allen due to his size, his mobility, and his arm strength. But I think he's very inconsistent with his throws. Had a bad transition period from the 22 season to last year. And again, kind of similar to Bo Nix, the system changed because they brought in a new offensive guy and it didn't gel well with what Drake May did in 22 versus what he did in 23. So again, you have to find that exact system. I'm not opposed to for guys to bring that system to, the NFL. But again, if that's not what the coordinator is used to, then that's where I think you can get a lot of trouble. I think the reason why Mac Jones was so successful year one in New England was because Josh McDaniels basically had the system that Mac Jones ran in Alabama. Outside of obviously all the elite talent that Mac Jones had the ability to play with in Alabama, Jerry Jeudy, Jalen Waddle, all those guys, Devontae Smith, when he got to New England, Mac Jones was best suited for Josh McDaniels' system. And when they allowed him a little bit more leeway, a little bit more of this, that's why there was so much hype behind Mac Jones, because it worked. That was perfect fit for him. And then Josh McDaniels goes against a head coaching job in Vegas, and then they bring in the two boobs, Patricia and Judge, right? So I feel like that's going to be the thing with Drake May as well as Bo Nix, is that they need that their systems in order to succeed. Plus, the other thing I didn't like about Drake May was I thought he was a poor decision maker. I thought there were a lot of times he stayed on his first read and just threw the ball, wasn't able to, you know, move around, open his views. Like, it was this guy or the highway. And it worked sometimes, didn't work a lot of other times. The number four quarterback is Jaden Daniels. And it's funny because I know a lot of people are like, the top three picks are going to be Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels, Drake May. That's what a lot of people are saying. Now, J.J. McCarthy's getting thrown into that bunch a little bit. But I believe that 2, 3, and 4 are very close to one another. So it's not like there is a clear delineation between Michael Penix in my book, J.J. McCarthy, and Jaden Daniels. There's no clear delineation. It is 2A, 2B, 2C, basically. And with Jaden Daniels, I love that he's a dual threat athlete, you know, has the ability to sling the ball downfield, going from Arizona State, playing with in the Pac-12, playing with Brandon Ayuk, and then going to LSU, playing with Malik Nabers. I mean, he's done it all in the Pac-12 and the SEC. You know, I think that Jaden Daniels is one of the guys that, even though he has the mobility, he looks to pass more than he does to run. And that always is a nice little checkbox in my book, because I don't want a guy whose first read isn't there and then immediately tucks and runs. I don't like that. I want a guy who can extend the play, find the extra man, find the, you know, second, third, fourth option. And then if you're getting chased, you got to hurry it up. You know, you got to move, then fine. Go, move, you know, get out of there. So I think he has that ability. I think he's more of a look to pass, then run type of guy rather than a run, you know, rather than he'd rather run than pass. And at the end of the day, he played in the toughest competition in college football, which is the SEC, and put up over 600, 700 yards against my beloved Florida Gators. So, I mean, he's a good ball player. He's a very good ball player, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Patriots take him at 3 if he's still available. There's reports that just came out that Jaden Daniels bombed his interview with Washington in order to play in New England. So I don't know how true that is. I don't know if Daniels, you know, wants to play in New England or what the case is, but if he does, all right. Like, I'm for it. Let's go. if Washington passes on him, I wouldn't be mad if the Pats took Daniels at 3. The one thing that some of the things I don't like about Jaden Daniels, though, is that he's got a slender frame for being 6'4". I know at his pro day, they finally weighed him, and for being 6'4", he's 210, and people say that he looks bigger, you know, which, okay, but there's still a lot about that kid where he needs to eat, Ben. He needs to eat. He needs to go. If he gets drafted by New England, he needs to go to the North End and stock up, man, because he's got to put on all that extra weight so that he can survive these 300, 10, 15, 20-pound guys falling on top of him. I think he tends to be more accurate on design rollouts rather than scrambling. So when he's throwing, like, they'll have him roll out, in which case all the routes are designed to go that way so that he doesn't have to throw across his body, and he's more accurate, in my opinion. And I think sometimes he tries to do too much. I think sometimes when he's run, there is – I just saw her actually earlier today. I forget the Twitter or the X handle, but there was a video of all the big shots that Jaden Daniels would take. And of course, it felt like a game of Sonic where all the rings would pop out, with all these massive shots. But it's like, for a guy that thin, if he's going to be on the move, it's not even the D linemen that scare me. It's going to be the linebackers that scare me, that are going to knock him cold, knock him senseless. And if he's that skinny, I don't know. I mean, what is he going to be able to survive? So the number three guy on my list is J.J. McCarthy. Now, initially, I had J.J. McCarthy probably around four or five, in my opinion. I like Drake May, but I was never totally sold on him. And so, if anything, J.J. McCarthy would be 4 or 5, something like that. But recently, a lot has been talked about, and I had to go back and watch some of the games, because watching in the moment, I sometimes don't even think. I'm just like more entertained than I am scouting. And when I would go back and watch Ohio State, right, this past season, you know, in the horseshoe, J.J. McCarthy came out and kind of stunk up a little bit. But then once they got the lead and the second, third, fourth quarter hit, the dude was money. Dude was absolute money. And I also heard a stat that J.J. McCarthy is number one in the nation on plays that are 3rd and 7 or longer. And so if you're telling me that a quarterback is number one in the nation on 3rd and 7 plus, sign me up, man. The other thing I like about him is, you know, he's got experience working in a pro-style offense, obviously focused more on the run game that Michigan was, because they had such a stout O-line. But, you know, he's able to do that. I thought he is capable of making those throws into tight windows. I think he's a smart runner. And as I mentioned, number one on 3rd and 7 or longer. I mean, if that doesn't say that this dude is a player, a baller, then I don't know what does. The only thing that I don't like about J.J. is the fact that he did run a pro-style offense, and it was very run-heavy, very Donovan Edwards and Blake Corum heavy. And J.J. McCarthy, it felt, you know, in during those times, like he was the second fiddle, you know, third, fourth, fifth fiddle, right? He's not the guy. And he was also behind the best O-line in the country. Now, I'm not saying the dude is perfect in that, oh, it's, you know, it's all these other things. I mean, trust me, he's got his flaws physically, but being behind a pro-style offense that focused on the running back and then having the best O-line in the country, the dude's got all day. How is he going to do behind this Patriots O-line when he's got barely 2 seconds after he touches that ball to think, you know, let alone get rid of it? Because we basically have the same O-line we did last year. No additions, no nothing. So I don't know why, you know, or what would make you think this O-line is going to be better than it was last year. You know, unless they hire Dante Scarnecchia back, which I don't think they're going to do, this O-line is going to suck once again. So that scares me about McCarthy. Now, number two being Michael Penix Jr. out of Washington, the guy that J.J. McCarthy played against in the national championship game. Honestly, I think, you know, you probably heard it a lot, but I agree with them. I said this from when I first started watching Michael Penix. He is the best passer in this draft, without a doubt. I love Michael Penix, is, you know, his arm. I think he's got the strongest arm, you know, being able to hit those out routes, those 15, you know, yard out routes. That's tough, right? Especially as a left-handed quarterback. You know, it's not easy for him. I think he's the best pure passer in this draft, without a doubt. But when it comes to the bad, it's simple. The dude, it has so much injury history. He has a bad shoulder. He tore 2 ACLs in Indiana and then moved with his coach to Washington and lit it up. And I'm glad he did. I'm glad that the Pac-12, he was able to bring the Pac-12 back, right? Of course, for that final year, the Pac-12 makes it to the the national title game and then subsequently loses to a team that they're going to be playing probably next season, because Washington, Oregon, USC, and UCLA are all going to the Big Ten. So the Big Ten's expanding out west. But Michael Penix, I love his game. If it wasn't for the injury history, he would 100% be my number one overall draft pick, without a doubt. If he didn't have that injury history, Michael Penix is my number one guy. And then, of course, number one, the most talented quarterback in this draft, in my opinion, is Caleb Williams. I'm not going to sit here and deny that the kid is talented. I don't do that. You know, I hate LeBron James, but I, you know, at least can see that the man is talented. I don't deny, Caleb Williams. You know, I think he's the most all-around gifted quarterback in this draft. My fear is he has got a selfish attitude. He is crazy to me. I mean, he had that big – like, I don't put a lot of stock into this, but the whole like, pink cell phone, the pink nails, like, I think that's just a little weird to me. Like, I don't look at that as, you know, something that breaks it overall, you know, but I think it's just weird. The thing that does stick out to me, though, in terms of his attitude and his mindset and kind of who he is as a player, is when he lost to, I want to say it was Washington, when he lost to Michael Penix in Washington, ran up in the stands and cried in his mother's arms. Like, not just cried, absolutely dry heaving cry. Like, just bawling his eyes out. And I know a lot of people want to sit there and say, oh, that's just passion, that's just emotion. I am all for that. But again, when it's your guy and the whole rest of the world can see it, I mean, listen, you lose a big game, there are plenty of guys, I bet even Michael Penix, I don't know for sure, but I'm just saying, you know, hypothetically, after they lost the national championship game, I wouldn't be surprised if Michael Penix was balling in the locker room with the rest of his team, right? So that's kind of where I'd, like, fine, go for it, be my guest. But to run up into your mother's arms in the stands and then just not cry, like, just, you know, like, no, just like, like, you know, the whole body's dry heaving, right? The whole body is, like, getting into it. I think that is, in my opinion, I think that goes a little bit too far. I think there's something going on upstairs with him. Plus, the whole fact that he goes on to talk about that everybody wants to be in my shoes, that he wants to, after a loss, he wants to go home, cuddle with his dog, and watch his stories. The team, that the backup quarterback for USC in the bowl game, goes off the 6 touchdowns and then subsequently, you know, throws some shade at Caleb Williams while the rest of the team is chanting, "We a team now." Like, it's stuff like that that kind of point out, okay, is this the guy? Is that guy from Draft Day? You know, Bo Callahan? Is Caleb Williams the Bo Callahan from Draft Day? You know, where none of the guys showed up to his birthday party? You know, right? You know what I'm saying? Because to have the players say, "We a team now," the one game all season that Caleb Williams didn't play in and wasn't even on the field for, like, I don't know. That's kind of suspicious to me. That's kind of suspicious to me. So I want to hear what you guys think. You know, do you agree with, you know, my assessment, my top six, you know, with Caleb Williams being number one and most talented? Again, I only rate these guys based off talent. You know, Caleb Williams 1, Penix Jr. 2, McCarthy 3, Daniels 4, May 5, Bo Nix at number 6. Let me know. I mean, I am all for, you know, you guys hitting me up. You can hit me up on any of these platforms here. Comment, like, share, subscribe. Let everybody know. I mean, I know it's a big topic of conversation. Who should the Patriots take? I would be happy if they went with Penix late in the first, early in the second. If they took McCarthy at three, or they took Daniels at three. I know there's a big boomer bust with Drake May, but to take him at three scares me. But that's why I wouldn't mind McCarthy or Daniels at three, or even though I know they haven't really talked to the kid, if they take Michael Penix later in the end of the first, early in the second, I would love it. Not Doug commenting. Sounds like another Johnny Manziel. Yeah. I mean, I don't think – I think Caleb Williams puts more work into it. I mean, if you saw the Johnny Manziel untold story where Johnny didn't even, like, watch any game film. You know, the coaches can see how much game film that they watch on their laptop. Johnny logged in 0 hours. I think Caleb Williams will put in at least an hour. But, I just think that Caleb Williams has got a lot of crap going around upstairs with him. And that's why it scares me to see stuff like that. It kind of scares me. And so now moving on, we got the Boston Bruins, who had a hard-fought battle last night against the Canes, but it just wasn't so. They should have lost by a lot more goals. I mean, you had that goal that they called off because the puck didn't 100% cross and there was no white to be seen, which, I mean, I thought that was a goal. So when they called it off, I was pleasantly surprised. But they just looked like they didn't want to be there last night. They almost looked like they were ready for the playoffs to begin. And ever since that Jim Montgomery ripped Boston on March 25th, the Bruins are, 5-2, I think, since the ripping, and including the loss to the Hurricanes last night. And so they showed up. They played better. I thought them being able to win those two games against Florida after, Jim Montgomery screaming at the guys kind of shows a lot. I'm still petrified of Florida. I'm still petrified of Carolina if we even see them. I think if we were to see Carolina, it wouldn't be till the Eastern Conference Championship, which I don't even think the Bruins are going to be getting to, if I'm going to be honest with you. But the one thing that report that I did hear, which, again, talking about alternating goalies, platooning the goalies, that is not a thing that goes on in the NHL playoffs. It just isn't. Have there been times where other goalies have come in to help out? Absolutely. And then the team will ride that goalie until they suck. But it's not like a traditional platoon like, Boston has done. Linus Ullmark posts a shutout just a couple of days ago, and the very next game, Swayman's playing. It's like, wouldn't you want to see Ullmark there again? It's what they've been doing all season. And so Montgomery comes out and says, quote, "I think if we commit to a rotation, it's going to be game 1, 2, 3, and 4. Then we go from there," end quote. And you know what? The more I think about it, the more I, hear kind of the people in favor of the platoon and why they should do it, even though it goes against everything that I know as a hockey fan, and everything that I, for lack of a better word, stand for, I don't mind it. I actually want them to do it. I want Ullmark to start game 1, Swayman to start game 2, and if Ullmark is a stud, Swayman sucks, game 3 is going to be Ullmark, then I want game 4 to be Ullmark. But if you get the two wins, or if it's, Ullmark wins, or let's say Ullmark loses, and then Swayman wins, but Ullmark, it was like a 2-1 game, something like that, and then Swayman wins like 3-1, whatever the follow-up is, then I don't mind going to Ullmark for game 3, right? If it's a good game, if it's close, then I don't mind it. But again, once game four hits, you're going to know, at least with what's going on recently, you know, and how Allmark's been a stud, posting a 950 save percentage to now Swayman, you know, kind of barely scraping 900 on his save percentage since the All-Star break. It's, I don't mind it. I kind of want them to now go to the platoon, because I guarantee you by game three, you're going to know who your starter is going to be for the rest of the series. I wouldn't be surprised, but anything can happen. And I, like I said last week, I am scared if they, if the Bees play the Lightning. I don't mind if they play the eighth seed, which I don't think we're going to, you know, I don't think we're going to beat the Rangers to get the number one overall spot in the Atlantic in the Eastern Conference. But we're only three points ahead of the Panthers with three games remaining. So it's still a possibility that we fall to the number two slot in the Atlantic, which would make us play Toronto. But Toronto and Tampa, they play the last game of the season against one another. So when you're looking at the standings as it is, if they – If it were to start today, yes, we would be playing the Lightning in the first round. But the Leafs have 101 points, and the Bolts have 95. The Bolts and Leafs both have four games remaining. So it's going to be interesting if you do that math. You know, if the Bolts went out with four games, it's 8 points, which would give Tampa 103 points. So Toronto would basically have to almost lose out. They could win one more game, but if they lose that final game against the Lightning, then I think Tampa would jump up. If they both have 103 points, I think Tampa would jump up to the number three slot, in which case the Bruins need to win the Atlantic. So the Bruins overall, though, it's going to be interesting to see how it all shakes out. And I'm actually kind of glad that Jim Montgomery seems to be coming around to the whole, let's go back and forth. Games 1, 2, 3, and 4. You know, we got Allmark, we got Swayman, we got Allmark, we got Swayman. It's what they've been doing all season. Swayman goes out, shuts a team out, absolutely dominates. Guess who's starting the next game? Allmark. Allmark does the same thing. Guess who's starting the next game? Swayman. The more I hear, the more I talk about it, the more I'm kind of like convincing myself. And I'm like, you know what? Fine. Do it. Let's not do it last season, you know, and leave Allmark in for the whole time. Let's do the rotation. That's what the team knows. And that way, it actually could take some pressure off Jim Montgomery. Because if you're just sitting there going, Allmark, you get games 1 and 3. Swayman, you got games 2 and 4. Done. No question asked. The team knows beforehand what's going to happen. Now, the only question would be by game 3, if Allmark performs well and Swayman doesn't, is Jim Montgomery going to have the balls to, you know, say, Sway, I know that I put you in for game 4, but you didn't perform in game 2. Allmark dominated in games 1 and 3. He's going to be our guy for the rest of this series. Then we can start it up again in the next series. I don't know. That's going to be the only interesting thing. And then finally, the Celtics. There's really not much to say. You know, we got the Bucks game last night, which was bizarre because the team just came out flat. They didn't care. They wanted the game, I think, to be over, seeing as it was the final road game of the season for Boston. But also, too, there was only 2 free throw attempts all game on both sides. Giannis Antetokounmpo was the only person to attempt any free throws. There was 2 of them. He went 1 for 2. So, like, in this day and age, I don't understand how that happens. Like, that to me was just too weird. You know, there's a lot – obviously, there's a lot going on, and obviously there's a lot where you got to sit there and be like, that's a foul, that's a foul, that's a foul. Like, what? How are we allowed – or how is it possible in this day and age to only have two free throw attempts? Like, that's just insane to me. But a couple games prior against Portland, Jaylen Brown hit the 10,000-point mark, joining the likes in order of all these Celtics that have scored 10,000 points wearing a Celtic uniform. John Havlicek, Paul Pierce, Larry Bird, Robert Parrish, Kevin McHale, Bob Cousy, Sam Jones, Bill Russell, Dave Cowens, JoJo White, Bill Sharman, Tommy Heinsohn, Jason Tatum, and Antoine Walker. So, congrats to Jaylen. I think it's a heck of an accomplishment, you know, being able to score 10,000 points. He's definitely going to pass Antoine Walker, but at least not for another season, maybe two. Unless, you know, hey, we trade him and, you know, he's stuck at 10,023 points. But that won't happen until the offseason. He'll score plenty more as a Celtic by then. So, yeah. So, it's the Celtics, myself, you, them. We clearly need the playoffs to start now. Because after that game against Milwaukee, the Celtics know they have the best record in the NBA. They're the best team by far. Giannis is now out with a calf strain after that weird inbound pass last night. And Milwaukee's the second best team in the Eastern Conference, at least according to record. And they haven't looked good. They haven't looked good as of late. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that the playoffs for the Celtics need to start. And the only thing that I will say about that game last night, though, is, you know, you had Derek White, Drew Holiday. Actually, no, I don't think you had White. But you had Drew Holiday, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum. Oh, no, and you had Derek White. They all played 30-plus minutes. So, and you lost that badly. Like, that's why I know, like, something was kind of weird with that game. Because when I saw that final score, I'll be honest, I watched only a few minutes of the game. I had to, you know, rewind it and watch it over. But I was surprised that the game went the way it did. You know, with the starters getting over 30 minutes, you know, being on the court. Why? You know, if this is how everything was going to turn out, like, well, you don't know how the free throws are going to turn out, but if you just threw these guys out there knowing full well that the lack of effort they gave because they kind of wanted to be the playoffs, I wanted to be the playoffs, you wanted to be the playoffs, why even bother? Just say that, you know, just throw your backups in, have them get all the playing time, something like that, and have one of the other guys going in. You know, and oh, you know, as we discussed earlier, Drew Holiday signing an extension with the Celtics for 4 years, $135 million. I mean, I think it's great. I think it's a good deal, both for the Celtics and Holiday. I think Holiday fits in so well with this team, and if we can keep it together, you know, obviously this offseason, Tatum's contract's going to be up, so he's going to get his max deal. And the Celtics, I mean, they're gonna be looking to pay. They're gonna be looking to pay, because they can't let a guy like Tatum walk. They just can't. So, I appreciate you guys tuning in, listening. We got a lot. Obviously, talk about the Red Sox. Are they on the verge of collapse? You know, with the game being going on as it stands right now. The score for the Sox is 3-0 through four. Sox are up 3 after 4 innings. So, again, it's not totally in the bag because the Red Sox last year, while they sucked on defense, they weren't out of it till August. As much as I wanted them to be out of it, you know, in friggin' June and May, their 2023 season basically ended in August. So, there's still a lot of room to be made up. It's just with all the news of all the injuries and everything going on, it doesn't look bright for the Sox this summer. Hopefully I'm wrong, but again, they got it. They got to make some moves. So once again, I appreciate you listening to the Boston Sports Summit presented by the Grid Network. I am your host, Tim Barnett. And please, it only takes 2 seconds. Please like, share, subscribe, let everybody know, family, friends, Boston sports fans or not, come check out the show every Wednesday, 7 p.m. here, over here, on the Grid Network. All right, Wednesday, 7 p.m. You can also find us on Spotify, Apple, wherever you get podcast audio from. We are there. Also, please, like, share, subscribe to my YouTube channel, Boston Sports Summit, as well as my ex Boss Sports Summit. Okay, you can type in Boss Sports Summit, you'll see it. And then over on my Instagram, Boston Sports Summit. So thank you so much once again. Also, we have Boston Sports Summit merch on the Grid Network. Link will be in the description below. So once again, thank you so much. And go out. God bless. Go Boston. Thank you.